Hello, everybody from the nation's capital. Welcome to an episode of the Politatine Podcast. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Zane Balian.
It's great to be here today.
Yes, it is. And today we have some interesting topics to cover. We're going to start, obviously, with the most significant issue. Today is the 22nd anniversary of the September 11th attacks that occurred, well, 22 years ago. It's going to be an interesting day. We're going to see remarks from President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. They're both going to deliver remarks in different locations. President Biden is going to be in Alaska, and Harris is scheduled to speak at the 9/11 Memorial and Museum Plaza in Manhattan.
It's an important anniversary as we look back and reflect upon those tragic events of the September 11th attack. And for us, it's especially important. So many here in the nation's capital remember the plane hitting the Pentagon and the sights of panic and frustration across the country. And as we reflect back upon those events, there's so much that can be said, not only about the terrorist attacks themselves, but the responses from this country and the 22, 23 years that have followed since those attacks. We're now on the fourth administration since those attacks. And although we continue to reflect upon the tragedy that happened, I think the way this country has grown from those attacks is quite substantial. And we can see that most notably in the past couple of years with the withdrawal of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. I think we've seen a country come to terms with a lot of these attacks, and we have moved forward in a way that I think we couldn't have said so maybe even 5 years ago.
Yeah, and something that's always, you know, interesting, especially when you're talking about the 9/11 attacks, is the slogan that's kind of been applied with it. It's never forget, right? And it's especially something interesting when you're taking it from the perspective of someone that wasn't there for the 9/11 attacks, like let alone wasn't there, but wasn't even born. Obviously, here at Politatine, we aim to bring you a nuanced perspective from the youth, and a lot of our viewers, as well as a lot of the people that work here on the program, weren't even around when the 9/11 attacks occurred. So it's interesting to see, you know, growing up, in particular. I attended a middle school that was actually built in, you know, in memoriam of the 9/11 attacks and what occurred on that day. And it's just interesting because, again, going back to the slogan of never forget, it's not necessarily that the United States has forgotten. But I think that we've reached a important pivotal point where the remembrance of 9/11 isn't so much so a memory of what can we do to, you know, get vengeance, almost to seek retaliation for these attacks. It's more so, what can we do to prevent these attacks on a larger world stage? And I think that this nuance also applies to something that we're going to talk a little bit later in the podcast, and that we're going to continue to talk about because it's a pressing issue. But the war in Ukraine, you know, you see these comments being made by the newer generation, as well as older pundits who were there during the war on terror and in the first Bush's administration, and seeing how decisions taken then did lead to the events that did occur on 9/11, and how to make sure that those events don't occur again, and how to make the United States a better player on the world stage. You know, coming off of an episode with Simon Anhold, it's interesting to see that, you know, this perception isn't just important. You know, the good country perception, the episode that we just had, isn't just important in terms of trade, in terms of world standing. It's also important when you think about terrorist attacks, right? Why did this happen to the United States, and how do we prevent it from happening in the future? And I think that it's that, you know, this particular remembrance does mark a kind of a turning point a little bit in terms of how we view the September 11th attacks.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned turning point, and I think maybe the best example of that is discussing the war in Ukraine, where for so long the war on terror was just the foreign policy issue. Yeah. That's what we cared about. That's what concerned us. We were concerned about Afghanistan, and we also were concerned about Iraq for whatever reasons. But because of how geopolitical situations have changed since then, right, with a rising China and with Russia taking intervening actions in Ukraine, the events of the war on terror have really been pushed into the background. And I think this might be the first time since September 11 that we really have moved on to different objectives in a way that, you know, throughout the Obama administration and even throughout the Trump administration, the war on terror was a lot of, for a big extent, the key issue. And that really isn't our goal anymore, right? And even with Middle Eastern policy, our goal was more about building alliances with the intent to combat Russian or growing Chinese influence, especially in the region. And we're no longer really as concerned with the Taliban or with other extremist groups in the Middle East.
Yeah, and another angle to view this at is also, if you will, the retaliation that kind of came as a consequence of the United States' decisions immediately following 9/11, whether that be the Patriot Act, whether that be the TSA, or whether that be a new issue that we see the United States military facing, which is recruitment problems. You know, newer generations are more hesitant to go and get involved in a war that, you know, a lot of them view as not having much to do with them and not having much to do with a fight for independence, democracy, and justice as was, you know, as was proposed post 9/11. I mean, we saw some of the highest recruiting numbers in United States history. We saw people, you know, lining up outside of recruitment offices for the Navy, for the Air Force, for whoever it may be, in order to go and fight for democracy and fight for the United States and fight against terrorism as it was proclaimed to have been. And, you know, in recent years, we've seen a shift. And it's not only in regard to recruitment numbers. It's not only in regard to the obviously the Patriot Act being being revoked and whatnot. It's also something super interesting. You know, the first episode back here on Politine, I had a chance to discuss what was happening in the Trump indictment. And one of the key figures there was America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani. What do you have to say about Rudy Giuliani's fall from grace from September 11th to now?
I think the most interesting example of Rudy Giuliani's fall from grace is, if you guys don't know this, that the Times Magazine annually publishes a person of the year, the most influential, most impactful, most relevant person throughout the year. And in 2001, they gave it to Rudy Giuliani. He was America's mayor. He was known not just around the country, but throughout the world for what he did in response to the attacks and how he led New York City through one of its darkest moments in its history. But since then, Rudy Giuliani has lost a lot of that respect that he built from the September 11th terrorist attacks. And I think a big part of that is a consequence of his ideological shift in the past 20 or so years, where I think maybe the best example of it is that he maybe became a little bit too cocky from those events. He felt too confident after being called America's mayor, where, you know, immediately after that, you saw him run for president. And I think he did so a few times, all unsuccessfully, never got the Republican Party nomination. And especially in the past few years, as Rudy Giuliani has become less relevant in the public consciousness, especially for people like us who are younger and don't remember
the cover. Yeah.
Exactly. We don't remember him being on Time Magazine. So I think he's tried to regain relevance in a lot of different ways. And a best example of that is him getting involved with the Trump administration, joining their team and being involved there, because it was a chance for him to have political power and be in the political spotlight once again. But I think in that desperation, we've seen him act carelessly and foolishly, and he's undermined a lot of what he stood for, to the point where the man who pioneered the RICO charges against the mafia has in the past couple months been charged with a RICO violation himself in Atlanta. And there is a great deal of irony in him specifically getting charged with a RICO violation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you have that picture of him on the Time cover in his suit and whatnot. And then you also hold that extremely juxtaposed 20 some years later with a mugshot in Fulton County, Georgia. And it's just one of these images that's a little bit, especially now coming into the actual remembrance of September 11th. It's something that is just shocking almost. And I think kind of speaks to this pivoting point that we were bringing up a little bit earlier, where it's, you know, we don't necessarily remember America's mayor. We kind of just look at Rudy Giuliani and we're like, wow, that's a really funny looking guy that is now has a mugshot. We don't remember him as America's mayor. And I think that that's significant. I think that it's going to be interesting to see how our generation responds to the September 11th attacks and how we remember them and what we take from them.
Yeah, and an example I wanted to make, especially to some of our viewers who do remember the September 11th attacks very vividly, is that although you might remember those attacks, for an older generation, their event was when Kennedy died. Mm-hmm. Everybody remembers where they were when Kennedy died. And for a generation that grew up after the Kennedy assassination, the way they might look at that event is similar to, I think, a way a lot of young people look at the September 11th attacks, where it was a key event that changed the course of this country's history forever. But we don't necessarily have the appreciation that people who lived through the events have, because we grew up in a post 9/11 country.
Yeah.
And that's something that, whether we want to or not, it's something that we take for granted, because we could never imagine what it was like to go through those attacks, especially for those people who are in New York or in Washington, D.C., while those attacks were occurring.
Yeah, and you know, shifting the point a little bit to another tragedy. This Friday, September 8th, there was an event in Morocco, an earthquake, and it was absolutely devastating. It was a 7.2 magnitude earthquake that has killed at least 2,100 people. As time goes by, there's expected to obviously be more victims uncovered. It injured an additional 2,400, but rescue crews are moving quickly in the area, trying to recover anyone that they can find. But again, it's one of those situations that we've seen in the past, and unfortunately, a lot more often than previously. But time is of the essence here. There's been a 3-day period of mourning declared by the king, and I mean, we'll see necessarily what this brings, but obviously a devastating set of circumstances for the people of Morocco. Our wishes go out to them, and if we can find any way to support, we will definitely have it in the description of this podcast, so please be sure to look for that.
Yeah, and what's been uniquely devastating about this earthquake was that it's occurred in some of the more mountainous regions of the country. So as a consequence of that, these communities were already very disconnected from the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very poor infrastructure, or maybe only one or two roads between the towns. So with much of that infrastructure destroyed by this earthquake, you have the government really struggling to reach out and offer aid to a lot of communities. And in a lot of the reporting from this earthquake, you can hear the frustration from a lot of communities throughout Morocco that feel like they have not been given any help yet. They've not been provided any aid. They haven't seen government support yet. And that's admittedly partially because it's very hard to reach these regions. It's very inaccessible. But we also can't forget that Morocco is also a very small country. And that earthquake hit nearly half of the country. It's been devastating in scale. And I think as Americans, it's easy for us to not appreciate how devastating a natural disaster can be in a community. Because, for instance, if Florida is hit by a hurricane, obviously the Floridian local government is going to help out. But on top of that, you have aid from the entire country. You have National Guards activated in nearly every state. FEMA comes in, offers billions of dollars of aid. And those are not resources that many smaller countries just aren't able to provide for themselves. And on top of that, Morocco has a very unique political situation. Even they have a monarchy, their king, Mohammed VI. He's been on the throne for quite a while. But they do have a parliamentary system. They have an elected prime minister. They hold free and fair elections. But a big issue in recent Moroccan history is that government, their elected representatives, they have to share power with the king. It's not a constitutional monarchy like they have in England or in Spain, but the king does hold a lot of ultimate authority. And in Morocco, you have a very divided government, many different political factions. So it's difficult for local people, especially in small towns, to be represented, to feel like their voices are heard. And it's exemplified this already poor situation because they don't have the resources or they don't have the means of recourse to contact their government to get the aid they need in the way that we take for granted here or in many other Western developed countries.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's going to be clear that the government is going to, you know, struggle to cope with the scale of this disaster. The WHO reports that 300,000 people were affected and felt this, you know, massive earthquake, as I mentioned, 7.2 magnitude. There's obviously the death tolls that are expected to rise in these upcoming days. Other countries in the region also felt this earthquake. I mean, it's an absolute massive event, and it comes in the wake of a series of devastating natural disasters that we've seen as a consequence of what many are reporting to be, you know, climate change. And, you know, going back to how we have responded to 9/11 as a new generation, this is also, I mean, the most pressing issue for our generation. You know, we remember in the Republican primaries a couple weeks ago, we had the question about how the Republican Party was going to come and reassure a young generation of Republican voters that have shown that climate change is the most pressing issue for them, that climate change isn't just a joke to the Republican Party. And then subsequently, right after, we saw the Republican Party, every single candidate on the stage, treat it as if it was a joke. Ron DeSantis saying we're not school children, Vivek saying that it's not real. It was an odd scene to see, but I mean, these natural disasters are expected to happen more often and more devastatingly than those seen in the past.
Yeah, and one more thing I wanted to mention with regarding specifically just childish activities is that in the Morocco situation too, there's been a lot of politics being played here, especially when it comes to foreign aid. Now, many countries have already reached out offering foreign aid, but Morocco hasn't accepted aid from all countries. They've accepted aid from Spain, the United Kingdom, Qatar, and the UAE, but they've refused to accept aid from France or the United States or Germany. And although there's a lot of speculation about why this might be the case, a lot of pundits have come to the conclusion that it's a matter of politics, that they don't want to be, for instance, taking handouts from countries that they don't necessarily appreciate as much, or they want to have a less amicable relationship with. But in a situation like this, it really is very disappointing. There are people who are still in great need, and some reporting says only just today, 3 or 4 days later, these communities are finally seeing government officials for the first time. So in a situation like this, I can't necessarily justify the decision the government is making to refuse foreign aid. Even if you have poor relationships with the country, your people need help, and that should be the biggest issue.
Yeah, and again, this follows a, you know, the similar pattern as what we saw occur in Turkey and Syria, where it was, you know, natural disaster occurs and all of the people left there are wondering, where are the responders? We don't have enough resources. And in the case of Turkey and Syria, they were taking you know, these resources from foreign countries, even ones that maybe their governments wouldn't necessarily politically align with, but nevertheless they were taking them as a priority to make sure that their people had the resources that they needed. So it's going to be an interesting developing story. And obviously, as more updates come along, we'll be sure to provide them to you on upcoming episodes of the Politine podcast. But with that being said, there's also something happening a little bit further east. Kim Jong-un. Earlier Monday, it was reported that Kim Jong-un is headed to Vladivostok. Okay, cool. In his bulletproof train to meet with Putin.
Yeah. This is always, traveling by train has always been a thing that the Kim family has done for a very long time. It goes back to his grandfather, Kim Jong-il, who has had a long historic superstition of flying airplanes. Now, why this is, there's a few reasons. Maybe it's because he just has a fear of heights, but there's been also speculation about whether this is just a consequence of lacking good aviation in the country and just a realistic position to avoid putting himself in an unnecessary risk. An example of this is a couple years ago when President Trump met Kim Jong-un in Singapore. In order to get to Singapore, Kim Jong-un needed to borrow an airplane from the Chinese government, one of them they use usually for Xi Jinping, to fly there, which is a good sign that they likely don't have the aviation resources to even transport their own world leader, which is a very telling sign about the situation North Korea is already in.
Yeah, and this is the second visit that Kim Jong-un has had with Vladimir Putin in, or since 2019. And the first one that, you know, Kim Jong-un has actually done, period, regardless of who he's meeting with. This is the first time that he is leaving the country since the COVID-19 pandemic. We remember reports amid the COVID-19 crisis that Kim Jong-un was sick. We got reports that he was sick. We got a report that he was extremely worried about the crisis. It was the same thing with Vladimir Putin. Apparently, Vladimir Putin didn't want to leave, to go anywhere because he was so worried about COVID-19. But we see these leaders coming together, and on the other side, you know, on the other side of Russia, from where they're meeting, you have a war going on. You have the war in Ukraine, and obviously it's been over a year now, and U.S. intelligence suggests and is a little bit concerned that North Korea could supply weapons to Russia for the war in Ukraine. What do you think about these U.S. intelligence concerns?
I think it is their analysis is probably realistic here. Russia has burned through a lot of ammunition in the war, and they're already in a very dire situation when it comes to their stockpiles of munitions, especially considering they do not have the domestic industrial capacity to be producing things themselves at the rate and at the speed that they've been consuming them. But it's also a very desperate sign to see that the Russians might be reaching out to the North Koreans in need for additional aid. And that's because North Korea has notoriously had very outdated equipment. A lot of the equipment they use currently is remnants of Soviet-era equipment that they got gifted back when the USSR was still around. And they have not necessarily modernized much of their equipment since then. But Russia seems to be in such a desperate situation that even 40, 50, 60-year-old North Korean equipment is useful to them because they just don't have other options or other allies or other resources available to continue to conduct this war at the rate and the intensity that they want to.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of speculation, going on whether North Korea will actually supply them. We had the National Security Council spokesperson Adrian Watson. She warned that arms negotiations between Moscow and Pyongyang are actively advancing. But is this actually something that, you know, Ukrainians at war should be concerned about? Is this something that the world should be concerned about? Or is this something that, going back to what you were saying, where we're dealing with North Korea, who won't even allow their leader to travel in their own aviation equipment because of the fact that it's so outdated and frankly dangerous. But yet they're committing considering to supply Russia with armament in order to continue their war in Ukraine. It seems a little bit, you know, desperate, I think, is the right word. So what level of concern do you think that this does bring to the national for Ukraine and international scale for everyone else?
Truthfully, I don't think this will probably be that big of an issue. Firstly, it's because North Korea has always had a long and historic relationship with Russia. So you couldn't really argue that they're getting necessarily much closer now. They've always been allies. They've always been partners. That's not necessarily a new development. Mm-hmm. What's more notable is the need for arms from the North Koreans. But like I mentioned earlier, those are very old, very outdated arms. And for the Ukrainians, who are currently being supplied with modern Western technology from the EU or from the United States, as long as they continue to get those shipments and those supplies in, I really doubt that whatever the North Koreans have to offer is going to be that substantial in combating the more modern equipment that the Ukrainians are being supplied with.
Yeah, and I think that it's something that as it's become more of a political conversation here in the United States, we need to remind ourselves and our leaders, frankly, that it is important to supply Ukraine with weapons that they need to defend themselves against the Russian attacks and to even, you know, get on the counteroffensive in some of these situations. It's a fight for sovereignty, and obviously we stand in solidarity with Ukraine. This is an interesting situation. Obviously, both North Korea and now Russia are kind of being ostracized on the international scale, on the international level, and they're facing scrutiny. Russia for its war in Ukraine, North Korea for being North Korea. It's something that is interesting. They're both trying to deepen their ties as this comes along. One last question on this topic, just to see, this is completely speculative, but do you you think that there's a potential for China to be utilizing North Korea as kind of a third party or a middleman, rather, in order to actually give Russia the, because we see that China was hesitant, obviously. We see Russia facing a lot of scrutiny, but we know that the ties between China and North Korea, as you mentioned earlier, giving things like planes for Kim Jong-un to travel on, are deep and have been there in the past, are historical. Do you think that there's a possibility, or do you think that it's a little bit too risky for China to even get involved in?
Well, China has had a long relationship with North Korea, and there's been a lot of speculation really recently, too, about whether China could supply arms for Russia. Now, I think China trying to be more involved in the international community has had a lot more hesitation. They don't want to change their foreign policy up that dramatically, that quickly. But I couldn't imagine that Beijing doesn't at least know what's happening in these meetings, or they don't understand what's going on. And being the country essentially bordering the two of them right in between, I assume that they do have strong opinions at this, and they're going to have an influence at the table, even if they don't have a seat at the table.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, talking about international conversations and ties being deepened, we had the G20 summit occur this weekend, and one of the things that the G20 leaders did not do was condemn Russia for its war in Ukraine. Thoughts on this?
This was also an issue that came up at last year's G20 summit. So I'm not entirely surprised that they didn't condemn Russia for the war, partially because, for instance, China is a member of the G20, and I doubt China would sign anything that was an explicit condemnation. I think maybe what's more striking is not necessarily that they did not condemn Russia, but I think they just wanted to move on from the conversation generally and focus on more economic issues. So it's interesting, and I think it's also partially escalated because the G20 was held in India, and I think India has always had a very long relationship with Russia, even though they're more hesitant, especially with growing ties between Russia and China. I still think that because of that long historic relationship, India just doesn't want to poke that bear. They don't really want to escalate it. So maybe if the G20 summit was held in a Western country, we could have a different dialogue happening. But with India as the host, I think they wanted to move on to more economic issues.
Yeah, and India being the host here is also something that's important as it comes to United States national security interests. We see Biden and Jake Sullivan, his national security advisor, taking measures to ensure that China does not have, you know, deep connections with other nations, weakening their, you know, just positioning and posturing the United States to be more significant than China on the world stage. And one of their biggest goals coming into the G20 summit was to deepen their ties with India. Obviously, we know that India is part of BRICS, which is, you know, an international coalition formed with members like Russia, China, India, South Africa, in order to just kind of come together. It's a counterpart to things that we see like NAFTA and NATO and whatnot. And it's a coalition that frankly has been concerning to Western democracies, and it's something that I know the White House has been keeping their eyes on. But do you think that India being the meeting point for this G20 summit was good for Biden? Do you think it was good for Jake Sullivan? Do you think it was good for United States interests as it relates to China and deepening connections with India?
Yeah, I think India is a unique example because they have very interesting relationships with all three of the great powers. Firstly, they've always had a very contentious relationship with China. They have a current ongoing border dispute with them that often starts tensions. So I think for the U.S. perspective, we aren't really worried about deepening relationship between India and China. But to that end, I think India also has had that kind of same reservations about the United States, where they see the U.S. as a big power that can push other countries around. And they've also kind of held the United States back with the stick too. So I think maybe the best way to look at it is that India has tried to build itself as a increasing power on the world stage. And I think they want to be seen as an equal to the United States, China, and Russia. And that's maybe part of the reason for their reluctance about deepening connections with any one of the three powers.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about wanting to present themselves as a greater player on the world stage, a major victory for the Indian Prime Minister was that this year, the African Union is now a permanent member. It's the second regional bloc to hold this status, obviously this is a win for India. This is something that they were aiming to achieve. They're trying to make themselves a legitimate a player in international conversation. What do you have to say about the African Union now joining?
Yeah, I do think it's an important step. The European Union has long had a seat at the table, and the African Union is an important body in trying to deal with issues on the continent, both economic and political ones. So they do have an important seat at the table and an important voice, and especially since African countries are so underrepresented in the G20, having the African Union get a permanent seat is important. Now, I will say I don't think it might be that big of a deal in terms of actual political implications, because for quite a while now, the African Union has usually been invited to these events as a guest, but making them a permanent member makes that official, and it really does show that Africa as a whole is becoming more relevant on the world stage, and that countries around the world understand that and they want to have them at a seat at the table.
Yeah, and we see, you know, over the past past several years, Africa has been African nations in specific have been developing significantly. We see that African nations and the African continent as a whole has had a booming population. We see that the global economics sphere is now being more and more influenced by Africa. So it's definitely something that I think is a right step forward in terms of international diplomacy, and something that we should definitely keep our eyes on in the following years as Africa becomes more of a serious player when it comes to international matters.
Yeah, and I think we've already started to see the beginning of that. A lot of countries, China, the United States, have put increased effort into investing in Africa and into building better relationships with African countries. European countries, too, have also made similar efforts. So there's a recognition all across the world that these countries are growing in population, their economies are growing, and it's going to be a future booming hub throughout the world. They're going to have a very big impact. So it is important to continue to invest in African countries and build those good relationships, and also help support their development and transformation into more rich, developed countries.
Absolutely. And with that being said, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Politine Podcast. Be sure to look out for more exciting interviews happening this month. We have guests like Michael Greiner, Zach Bornstein, Larry Lawton, and many, many more interesting personalities coming onto the podcast to have deep conversations about corporate responsibility, to have some more lighthearted conversations about how comedy has changed since the Trump administration, and to talk about prison reform. So be sure to stay tuned and up to date with everything that's happening with regard to Politine. New episodes drop Monday and Wednesdays at 9:30 a.m. And to see everything that we're involved in, be sure to head over to oxinstitute.org. And with that being said, once again, thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of Politine. Goodbye.